listening to 88.9 FM, KUCI Irvine. The opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views of KUCI or the University of California, Irvine.
Good morning and welcome to this November 14th, 2018 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone, doing what we do each and every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, their process, their craft. So I pre-recorded both authors last week, and I had to do a little bit of editing and cut a few minutes from each. So if you like what you hear, you want to hear a little more, the full interview will air on the podcast, which is a nice reminder. If you haven't already, I encourage you to follow us on iTunes. We are under Writers on Writing, where you will get notifications when we podcast new shows and past shows are up there. You can follow us on Facebook. We're under Writers on Writing KUCI FM. You can follow us. You can follow KUCI in general on Facebook and find out all of our fantastic programming. Podcasts can be found of this show at writersonwriting.blogspot.com. But seriously, subscribe to the podcast. I bring you now young adult rock star Marie Lu, and in the second half, debut novelist Rita Dragonette will be on. Marie Lu is the number one New York Times bestselling author of the Legend Trilogy and the Young Adults Trilogy. She was on the show with me in 2015 talking about The Rose Society, which is the second book in the Young Adults, in the Young Elite series. Marie graduated from the University of Southern California and jumped into the video game industry, working for Disney Interactive Studios as well as a Flash artist. Her latest, Wild Card, is a sequel to War Cross, which came out last year. We'll talk about that duology, creativity, process, craft, all of it this morning. Marie, welcome back.
Hey, thank you so much for having me back.
Oh, thanks for coming on. So the last time you were on, three short years ago and three long books ago, we we talked a lot about video gaming and your obsession with that, and we were chatting about the possibility of somehow marrying your two passions, gaming and writing. I think actually we were talking more about how to turn your books into games, but now you've achieved putting gaming into your books. So congratulations. That's really cool.
Thank you so much. Yeah, it's something I've been wanting to write for a while.
Yeah. So I'm going to let you set the stage for these books, assuming some listeners who aren't familiar with them kind of take us into the world of Warcross and Wildcard.
Sure. Warcross and Wildcard are a duology. They are science fiction set in the very near future, so pretty much our present day, and follow the story of what happens when a game called Warcross takes our world by storm. Like, everybody plays this game. It is embedded in virtual reality and augmented reality, and it's basically like a worldwide sensation. So everyone plays. It was invented by a 13-year-old boy named Hideo Tanaka. And as the story opens, he is 21 and kind of like the most famous person in the world. And the story follows a girl named Amika Chen, who is 18 years old and living on her own in New York City, trying to make a living as a bounty hunter and a hacker. She has, you know, no relative to speak of, nobody to fall back on, not really any friends. She's kind of down on her luck. You know, bounty hunting and hacking don't really pay very stable income. You know, it's not like a stable income for her. So she, as the story opens, has like $13 to her name. She's $6,000 in credit card debt. You know, things are not going well for Amika. She's a huge Warcross fan, and she's, you know, followed Hideo's rise in the world since, you know, he first came on the scene. But, you know, she's kind of getting desperate to make some money. She's about to get evicted from her apartment. So she, in desperation, decides to hack into the international championships for Warcross, and then accidentally hacks herself into the game. So everyone sees her. And the next day, she is on every headline, the front of every newspaper. Everyone's like, who is Amika Chen? She's got all these journalists, you know, at her front door, and the news are there, and she's, you know, trying to figure out what happens. And then she gets a phone call from Hideo himself, who says, hey, I have a job offer for you. Would you like to hear more? And so from that point on, Amika's life just goes completely off the rails, and she gets swept up into this you know, the world of glitz and glamour that Warcross is, but also the seedy underbelly of it, the dangerous side, the edgier side, and that's kind of what Wildcard, the second book, delves into, and she kind of has to find her footing and figure out what is morally right for herself. So that's a little bit about the book series. I think it's my favorite thing that I've ever written. So I hope that people enjoy it.
So talk a little bit about how the book presented itself to you. If it was that idea of marrying video gaming and virtual reality, if it was Amika's character, kind of what was, you know, what was the initial spark there?
Yeah, like you said, I had always been interested, you know, in video games. I've always loved it, and I always knew that I was going to write something in the gaming world. You know, I wanted to do that. I just didn't know what kind of story I wanted to tell. And I was thinking back on the last book in my Legend trilogy, where we get to see a gamified futuristic society that exists in what is future Antarctica. And it's a society that's completely taken over by a game, and that's mentioned very briefly in the Legend series, but I never really got to explore it. So after a while, I kind of got the idea to write a new series based on that idea and expand on it a little bit. So that plus like the recent interest in virtual reality and augmented reality that we've been seeing in the news kind of came together, and that was how I started off with the idea for Warcross.
Talk a little bit about how much research into artificial intelligence this required, and kind of if there were big surprises to you in doing that research, or if you kind of felt the license to, you know, it's fiction, so you can do whatever you want.
A lot of the science fiction in it is not science fiction at all. I did end up doing a lot of reading and research on, you know, on like Wired magazine and that sort of thing, just to see what the current trends are. And part of the challenge of writing this series was that I was writing it so in such a near future sense that I had to know what was happening in real time, and it was really difficult to, you know, keep up with that. So a lot of the science fiction in the book is not really science fiction at all. I think everything has happened already. So I think a lot of it has come to pass. I get article links all the time from readers who will send me things like, did you know that Elon Musk, you know, created a Neuralink? Like, it's called the Neuralink in my book as well. And he's like, they're like, it's this brain-computer chip interface that they install in your brain that lets you access the internet. I'm like, what? That's really creepy. So it's just been really interesting to see that happen also, in real time and keep up with it.
Yeah. Also creepy that Elon Musk is reading your hard drive, coming up with the same names that you came up with. That's crazy.
I know, right? I was talking to my editor, and I'm like, do we need to change his name? Are we going to get sued?
Right. Did he get there first? Or
right. Yeah, I have no idea.
It's crazy. So I was kind of on this notion of plot versus story. I was talking to a novelist this weekend who was stressing the importance for her of starting with kind of some big question, some either ethical or philosophical question, whatever it was, but that there's some sort of core issue that drives her initial curiosity, and then the book starts to make sense from there, that it kind of dictates who the characters become and how the plot unfolds. And I was kind of wondering, with some of these big questions about, you know, where technology is taking us and our experience of the world is changing so rapidly as we're living more inside our screens, if it was kind of some bigger question that was driving you through this and that kind of dictated your characters, or, you know, kind of if that rang true to you at all, or if you work a different way.
That is so fascinating to hear through her process. I knew that I was going to be putting in a lot of those bigger questions, kind of like the things that have been keeping me up at night about technology and how quickly it's moving, and how we're trying to, many times in vain, adapt to that speed. And so I knew some of it was going to go into story. I tend to start at a place where I'm just trying to write an entertaining story, and I think a lot of the deeper things, the meatier themes fall into place as I'm drafting. So it's a more chaotic process for me. I'm not as organized about it as that. Like, I don't tend to know everything that I want to talk about or delve into as the story begins. So for me, it was more about, I really want to make this game, and it sounds so fun, and I want to explore, you know, how Amika reacts to all of it. And then as I'm writing it, all of these thoughts that I've been having will find their way into the story somehow. Mm-hmm. And I go back and read over it for revisions, and I'll see myself trying to come to terms with, you know, questions like, how are we dealing with technology? Like, should we be making this technology? You know, should we be slowing down? Is that even possible? And so it all kind of falls into place as the revisions go on.
Yeah, right. You're so great at world building that isn't boring. Like, you know, I mean, this is so complicated, and it's a game overlaid with virtual reality. But you managed to make it really clear to the reader. And I don't know if there's a way for you to talk about this process for sci-fi writers or writers that are kind of working in this genre, of how you build these really complicated worlds with complicated rules for readers to understand, or if it's just so kind of organic to your process that there's no way to talk about it. But it's impressive.
You.
Yeah, it's impressive.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad and relieved to hear that it comes across clearly. It kind of comes in piecemeal, too. I think I use that word a lot when it comes to my writing process. Mm-hmm. It all is kind of chaotic. I think we may have discussed this a while ago before, but I'm kind of a pantser writer. I don't tend to outline my stories out before I begin them. So a lot of it happens as I'm writing, mm-hmm. and that's the same for my world building. I tend to do maybe half of my world building before I begin drafting my story, and then as I'm writing the first draft, the second half of that world building will come in, and I'll realize what I'm missing, like the pieces that I need, you know, to put back into the story, you know, what else I need to know about what characters do in this, you know, in the case of Warcross, inside this game, what's it like to be a champion, you know, what's it like to be famous in the world of Warcross? What is it like to play in the game, and how do you move, and all of these things? Kind of the questions fall into place for me as I'm drafting, because I realize what's not there. So it all kind of comes in bits and pieces as I go. It's kind of a chaotic process. I don't know if it's not a terribly organized way of thinking things through, but I think it does help me keep it relatable, at least to myself, which hopefully translates to other readers, because, you know, a lot of the things are not things that I'm familiar with even. You know, I'm not a hacker of any kind. Like, I don't know how to program or any of that. So I'm learning at the same pace as an outsider is. And hopefully that is something that makes it a little bit easier to follow the world, for the readers.
So,
I hope that helps.
Yeah, no, that does help. I mean, that does help. I think that's how it happens for a lot of people, is through that horrible, awful revision process of trying to figure out what works and what doesn't, and then smoothing it over. So, yeah, that does make sense. To the point about you learning along with the reader as you go, and we touched a little bit on research before, but was there research in other regards that went into this, that as you're in the revision process, you're finding yourself looking things up and sort of what sort of things were you having to look up?
Oh, all the time. Yeah. I have to stop all the time to do searches. In this case, it was a lot of making sure, like, is this technology already outdated?
Right.
Is there some better thing that people are doing now? I read a lot of TechCrunch, a lot of Wired, and it was kind of harrowing to be like, oh, maybe VR is going to be totally nothing anymore by the time the book comes out. Are people even going to be talking about augmented reality? It's just so fast. So I did find myself pausing constantly to kind of check on things and see, you know, has anyone invented this thing yet, or that thing, and should I be talking about it differently? And It felt like a constant race against reality when I was writing this book.
It's crazy. It's wonder. I kind of brings up the question of whether you see a nearish future about how books are going to be consumed based on where things are going technologically. You know, if these things are being embedded in our brains as we speak, you know, for if that's technology already exists, it's you know, you start wondering if we're just going to be uploading books to our brain pretty soon instead of sitting down and consuming. I mean, we're already having all these conversations about e-readers versus physical hard copy books, and maybe we're just going to jump over that whole conversation and have them embedded in our brains.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah, maybe it'll be like the Matrix when, you know, in 10 years or so, we just wake up knowing Kung Fu.
Right.
Right. I don't know. It'll be interesting. It'll be interesting to see where it goes. I feel like every time I think I've predicted something for what's going to come next in our world, something else comes along where I'm like, I never in a million years would have thought that, you know, this would have taken off, or, you know, now we all take Ubers and Lyfts, and now we all, you know, there's always something that just comes out of nowhere that kind of takes our lives over.
And it's such an accelerated pace. Yeah.
Exactly. At such an accelerated pace, like every 2 months. 2 months is an eternity in a tech world.
And, you know, we integrate it into our lives so quickly. I mean, we're so adaptable as humans that it's, anyway, that's a whole different radio show topic. But so I'll try to stick to the writing part of it. But yeah, it's just fascinating. My guest this morning is Marie Lu. The book is, the first was Warcross. The most current is Wildcard. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. So last time we also talked about you doing character sketches in your notebook, like physical drawings of your characters to kind of get the look and feel of them. And, I assume you did that this time as well.
I did. Yeah. It helped a lot.
I always wondered, after we talked last time, if that helps you. We never really talked kind of about voice creation and finding the voices for all of these characters. And I wonder, for writers who think visually as you do, I don't think like that, but I was thinking that would be a very effective, perhaps, way of getting into a character's voice and distinguishing them from other people. If you could kind of physically see them and spend time with them on paper in a different way, in a visual way, before you start writing their character. And I was wondering if that translates at all to creating their voice and to creating kind of how they talk and see the world.
Oh, absolutely. That's such a great point, because it really does, for me at least. I think that's a huge part of why I have to draw them out before I ever start writing. It's like I can't get a hold on who that person is until I can see them. So voice is very much a part of that exploration. I'm very chaotic with my writing, but I do tend to write very extensive character profiles before I begin. And the character sketches are all a part of that process. So as I go, I learn their voice. And the more I can understand about them, the more I see their, you know, the sketch of their expressions on paper, the better an idea I can have of who this character is. I will also tend to write what I call white room scenes before I begin my first draft, which is where I will take several of my characters and just throw them into a white room and just write dialogue between them just to see what happens between them. Do they get into a fight? Do they fall in love? You know, does something else spark between them? And that helps me also figure out their voices and how they kind of distinguish from one another, so they don't have, you know, too many of the same kind of character in my cast. So all of that kind of happens before I begin. Because that way, when I do start my first draft, I do have a good sense of the voice.
That's interesting. How many pages would you say you write that will never see the light of day for the prep work?
Oh, gosh. It depends on the book, I guess, but for Warcross, probably a good third.
Wow.
Of the book. I'm sure I have like 20 or 30,000 words lying around that are both just notes that I've taken to, you know, for myself, world building and character building, and also scenes that never make it in, outtakes and, you know, random character explorations and that sort of thing.
Right.
So quite a lot.
Quite a lot. So let's talk a little bit. The last time we talked, we just got started on talking about the importance of writing really bad first drafts And I wanted to sort of stress again to writers how important just sitting down to writing really bad stuff is. So I was wondering if you could, I mean, we started in on this a little bit, but just give writers a sense of the messiness of this process. If you could talk a little bit about the first draft of either Warcross or Wildcard, like what that first thing looked like, what huge things may have changed, where it started versus where it ended, kind of all those, you know, it kind of give us a sense of how much your first draft differed from that last draft.
Oh, sure. Wildcard especially, I think the first draft, like a full third of that first draft, never made it into the final version of the book. I think the same as with Warcross. It's a pretty standard thing across all of my books. I'd say a full third of it never makes it in. And, you know, I'm currently working on a new draft for an upcoming project that's coming out in a couple of years. And, you know, it's NaNoWriMo. It's, you know, National Novel Writing Month right now. So the goal is to just write 50,000 words of a draft before, you know, going back and editing any of it. So that's what I'm doing right now. And it's just awful. I can't even. I was working on it earlier this morning and things was like, oh my God, this is the worst thing I've ever written. I am truly a fraud. Like, no one is ever going to want to read another book by me again. Like, all of those thoughts. And I've had those thoughts since I was an aspiring writer. And I still hate writing bad first drafts. It just, like, you just want to put down the perfect thing, you know, in your first try on the paper. And I just have to come to terms with the fact that it's never going to happen and it's okay. And I just have to get, like, quantity over quality is the goal at this point, right? So I'm going through that process right now and struggling my way through, like, the first third of this new book and just hating everything about this draft. And I know it's bad, but I know that I have to have something to work with, you know, if I'm going to go back and try to make something better. And that's been true for every single one of my books. And they've all gone through that gauntlet. Wildcard was especially hard. It was harder than Warcross even, just because it was the ending of a duology. I've never written a duology before. I didn't realize that you have to tie up everything in basically the end of the second book, which I've never done, and that was a challenge in itself. So it's always a struggle, and I hope that's kind of inspiring in its own way for aspiring writers, because, you know, pretty much every writer I know, no matter how successful, struggles with that first draft.
I know. I was just having a conversation. Well, Andre Debus was on last week, and he said the same thing. He was like, I just think this is the worst thing I've ever written. I don't know. And I said, God, how long do you have to write before you have some confidence in what you've written? And the answer is forever.
Forever.
It's just forever.
Yeah.
So the last time you were on, we must have a thing about second books here, because the last time you were on for the Rose Society, which was the second in the Young Elites trilogy. And you were talking then about, you know, just how dreadful it is to write the seconds are just so very difficult. And, you know, you have painted perhaps yourself in a corner from whatever you wrote in the first book. Right. And I was wondering if, which it sounds like you alluded to, that this was just as painful as the Rose Society.
Oh, yeah. And part of the reason why I thought it was going to be easier was that, you know, I was choosing to write a duology this time, and I was like, oh, this is great. I hate writing the second book in a trilogy, so this way I'll skip it. But it turns out that the second book in a duology is basically books 2 and 3 mushed together into one book, so you have to do twice the work in half the time, and you have to tie up everything again. So, you know, I kind of screwed myself over on that one.
How many pages are you putting out a day? Because you're putting out a book a year, and you're throwing a third of a book away each time you write a book. So I'm just wondering how you just must be a machine over there.
I wish I was. That would be awesome if there was a machine. But in general, I don't think of myself as a terribly fast writer, actually. I know a lot of people who can write, you know, 4,000, 5,000 words a day, and I don't think I've ever been able to do that in a day. So, you know, I'm doing NaNoWriMo. If I can get 1,500 to 2,000 words a day, I think that's a phenomenal day for me.
Yeah.
That's a lot for me. And so it'll take me 2 to 3 months to get a really, really, really rough first draft down, and then another at least half a year of making sure that that's polished. So my books are kind of staggered a year out, mm-hmm. and I'm turning in the first draft of a book about a year before it comes out, and all that rest of that time is revision. That's how long it takes for me to actually polish it into something that people can read.
Right.
So it's not terribly fast, but I'm trying to keep up with it and trying to always find new ways of making my writing more efficient.
Yeah, yeah. Have you noticed that the YA world, I mean, the mm-hmm. technology world is changing so incredibly fast? And I was wondering if the YA world, because your teenage audience is so enmeshed in, you know, mm-hmm. in that technological world, I was wondering if that
right.
work, or if your audience, if you have noticed changes in them since you've been in the business.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and I don't know if similar things happen in adults or in the younger categories, like picture books or middle grade, but in young adult, you know, when I first came out, it was right around the time when The Hunger Games was on its way up. Mm. And I feel like the YA industry was incredibly different at that time. You know, we were all kind of wrapped up in dystopia, and there was this new wave, like a trend hitting the market, and it was a very different time, I think, in terms of what readers were drawn to. And, you know, I think that YA today, as it stands, it's aged up in general. I think that YA themes have gotten older, mm-hmm. And the storylines have gotten older. And not necessarily a bad thing, it's just very different from, you know, what was considered YA when I first entered and what's considered YA now. So it has to do with the aging of our audience too. A lot of readers who were teenagers when I first began writing are now, you know, in their 20s and still reading YA and still enjoying it, and they have very different needs, you know, from the genre. And at the same time, you know, there's new young people coming into the category and exploring what's out there, and they live in a time that is different from what things were like in 2011. And like you said, technology has changed so much in that span of time. Like, Instagram didn't exist yet when I first started mm-hmm. writing, and now it's basically all that I use. And, you know, young people use, I mean, even that's changed now. They used to use Snapchat or Snap, and now they've kind of switched over to using Instagram stories, and it's just a lot of that change, you know, you can kind of feel it rippling through the YA industry as a whole, because, you know, we're trying to write stories for this very, very rapidly changing group of young people, and trying to still find, you know, those kernels that will resonate no matter what kind of technology is out there. And so it's a challenge every year, I think, but always fun. It's I've never been bored trying to find the right stories for young people.
Well, and to your earlier point about the world that these kids are in, you know, when you were writing in 2011, I mean, the political world was so much different. So dystopia mm-hmm. probably
oh,
had
gosh.
Far more appeal than now. I'm sure kids are like, I don't need any more dystopia. I can mm-hmm. just turn on the TV. Now I'd rather escape. And so virtual reality is actually very nice.
Exactly. Yeah, it's just mind-boggling how different the political landscape is. Midterms are tomorrow, and I can't even imagine what it must be like being a young person today, seeing the political landscape.
That was Marie Lu talking about her duology, Warcross and Wildcard. And like I said, I had to cut that interview off just a few minutes early. So if you're interested in the full thing, you can get that on our podcast. And we are Writers on Writing on KUCI, 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. You can find us, writersonwriting.blogspot.com. You can, of course, subscribe to our podcast at iTunes, Writers on Writing, for direct downloads. And onward with the show. Next up is Rita Dragonette with her debut novel, The 13th of September, coming up next on KUCI, 88.9 FM in Irvine. Rita Dragonette is a writer who, after spending nearly 30 years telling the stories of others as an award-winning public relations executive, has returned to her original creative path. The 14th of September, her debut novel is based upon personal experiences on campus during the Vietnam War. She is currently at work on three other books. She lives and writes in Chicago, where she also hosts literary salons to showcase authors and their new books for avid readers. We're going to talk about that and more. Rita, welcome.
Well, thank you very much, Maria. I'm glad to be here.
Thank you so much for coming on. So I may have mentioned this to listeners on the show before, but I was so particularly intrigued by this. My dad was a Vietnam vet, and I was born after the war, but I kind of came to feel like the Vietnam War was almost another family member in our house growing up. And so whenever I see books written about the war, people in, you know, kind of captivated by that time of our history, it... my ears always perk up. So this was wonderful, and I've never read a take on the war, anything like this. So this was a treat. I guess before I get too far into that, I should allow you to introduce the book and kind of take us into the 14th of December and clue our listeners in on what I'm talking about here.
Oh, sure, I'd love to. The 14th of September is a woman's story of Vietnam, which does make it distinctive. And it follows Private First Class Judy Talton, who is in college on a military scholarship, which is the only way that she can afford to go to school and have the kind of independent life she wants. But the time frame of the novel is late 1969, early 70, and Judy has been having doubts because the war has been escalating. And because in her program she's actually enlisted in the Army, she's wondering if she's complicit and how she should be feeling about it. So what she does is, as the book opens, she decides to celebrate her 19th birthday, which is the 14th of September, by secretly going underground into the campus counterculture just to see what the other side thinks. And by doing this seemingly small exploratory step, she actually puts her entire life into jeopardy. If the Army finds out, she will lose her hard-won scholarship and her relationship with her military family, her future. She could even face legal action. If the counterculture finds out she's in the Army, they'll think she's a spy. And all of this takes place on a backdrop of these huge things happening historically, the March on Washington, the draft lottery, Kent State, and Judy is plunged into a journey of self-discovery that I call a coming of conscience, to the point where she feels that she needs to make a decision that is every bit as emotionally fraught and difficult as any that is by any male draftee of the time.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about your point of entry into the novel and kind of how it came to you, if you feel like you found this book or if you feel like it found you, and if it began with character, if it began with circumstance, sort of the origin story for you.
Well, it was actually a very personal story. The foundation of the things, of Judy's dilemma in the story, being on a military scholarship and being conflicted, is something that I actually encountered at that time. And there was something that did happen to me, and it is it's reflected in a scene in a book, which really was the first time that I ever felt like I was a coward, and it was during this time on campus, and there were people for inappropriate reasons, of course, dissing a vet, and I was furious, and I thought, oh my God, I've got to get up and say something and stop this, no one else is doing this, and I did not do it because I was a girl, and I didn't think anyone would listen to me. Mm-hmm. And I sort of vowed that I was never going to feel like a coward like that again, and I was certainly never going to let, this was the early years of feminism, I was never going to let my female status get in the way of that. And then when I left school about a year later, somebody who was at school with me and in this sort of group of characters sent me a letter and said, there is a story in those years, and you're the one to tell it, and those who know me would know if you give me a quest, I'm like a dog with a bone. So I always knew that I needed to write this story, And I always knew that it had to be a woman's point of view. I'm very interested in women in war. My mother was in World War II. But just the fact that women go through, like you said, your whole family felt like it was in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it's in your family, if it's in your whatever, you know, the women go through the same thing the men do. Men do in terms of intensity and horror. Death means different things in different ways. Grief means different things in different ways. And I always felt that men and women had equal status, but that it wasn't always recognized. And Vietnam was a very good example of that.
For sure.
And it hadn't, and no one was telling the story. Right. I kept waiting for it to be told, and here it was.
Right, right. Well, I'm glad you did it, because we could have a whole separate hour-long discussion on all the things that I could unpack in my own life, but if we had time for that, but it really resonated on a lot of levels. And, you know, it's hard to read this book when knowing that you started it, I guess you started, so it took you 12 years to write. And so you must have started it kind of during the Bush administration. You were writing it during throughout the Obama administration. And I just always think it's interesting. You know, I always talk on the show about the world the book is born into. And this is yet another one that it's coming out in a world, in a context that looks so hauntingly familiar in certain ways to the world that you were writing about. And I guess the first question for that is, through the dozen of years that you were writing the book, the story is the story, and Vietnam is fixed in time, and the characters are who they are. But I wonder if the outside world, if you could feel the world changing around you, if you felt like that had any impact at all on your writing of the book. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I call it the hamster wheel of history. And there were, as I went through a great deal of these moments of time, I kept thinking, oh my goodness, I should have written it years before, and maybe then some of these things wouldn't have happened. You know how you get very, as if I could control that. But, you know, you watched the generation that was involved in the 14th of September, which is set 69-70, is the one that was going to change the world. And, you know, we failed at that. We tried really hard. We were definitely instrumental in ending the war, but it didn't really feel that way because it went on for another 5 years. And, you know, a lot of us got kind of gutted and we went into the me generation. You know, I don't know that I can have faith in government after this. I'm going to take care of myself and my family and all of this. But you always wanted to come back to it. So here I am going through three careers. I was in PR and then I was a consultant. Trying to work on the book part-time while you're doing that. And trust me, don't start a business and a book at the same time. It always wins. But yes, we went through all of those different eras, and it actually felt like it was going to get a little more hopeful, you know, right, with Obama. But then the Never Again movement comes in, and that's got four factors that are the most similar to what we went through in Vietnam, and which is staggering. You know, it's young people who don't have a political voice and no vote, and their government's not taking care of them with legislation, and their institutions aren't taking care of them, and their parents aren't by voting for the right people. And that's exactly the kind of thing we were going through in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the people that were going were 18, 19, and 20-year-old teenagers, children.
Right.
And the line was, if you remember from those days, was that you were too young to vote, but not too young to die.
Right.
And, you know, so we know that political power was really, really important, and we didn't go after it that much. And so you watched Bush, and you watched all these different things come through, and I just felt like, oh, my God, this is uncanny.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just uncanny. I was actually having one of my literary salons, and we were talking about my book at the end of the introduction of someone else's, the night that Trump sent... You remember he called it the mother of all bombs?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
That just sort of went in, and it was uncanny. And I got a text from someone during the salon, and he said, okay, here we go again.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So it's here. You know, it's definitely here.
I always converse with writers about whether or not the universe is showing them signs that they're, because writing a novel is so long and it's so hard and it's so tedious. And so I often ask, you know, kind of what sustains you during those long years, and does the universe ever give you any signs that you're on the right track, or that what you're doing is really important, or that, you know, the world is listening? And it sounds like you got more than your fair share there.
Well, I have to tell you that for most of the years I was writing the book, lots of people were saying things like, why are you writing about Vietnam? It's bad. We lost. We did terrible things to Vet. We did atrocities. Who cares, you know, Obama? But I knew that it was more important than ever than to go ahead and do that. And somebody actually, one of my salons, called Vietnam the Voldemort of wars, you know, that which will not be named. And that doesn't make history go away. I mean, it's in the DNA of all of us and our country and how we have done these different things. So I was, like, compelled. And then Ken Burns comes out.
Right.
And talk about a sign from the universe.
Right.
So I spend 10 years or so writing this with people saying, why bother? No one's going to, you know, care about this. And then Ken Burns comes out with his remarkable PBS series that I feel that every American should see.
Yes.
And then Spielberg comes out with The Post. And then 3 weeks ago, do you watch This Is Us?
I have watched the first season, and then I kind of dropped off halfway through the second season, so I'm not caught up, I'll admit.
Well, about 2.5 weeks ago, 2 weeks ago, something like that, they had an episode, and it was about the draft lottery.
Oh, my God. That's funny.
And it was right out of my book, as I depicted. And it was also a perfect analysis of why we can't forget any war, let alone Vietnam, because in that television show, which is incredibly popular, yeah, a son is trying to understand his father's experience in Vietnam so he can understand himself and his dynamics and his family.
Yeah. Yeah.
And isn't that why we write historical fiction, and isn't that why we study history, to learn the lessons so we don't get into the hamster wheel of history?
And look where we are, right?
Yeah,
right.
I know.
So good. So I had read that a writing professor sort of gave you permission to use just the foundation of yourself to get into this novel, because I think that's one of the very difficult things for a writer to sit down. Even if you know what you want to write about, just trying to find the door in on that blank screen is really difficult. And so I was wondering if it felt just like wonderful permission for this mentor to say to you, look, you can take your own life as much as you need to just shove off from the side of the pool. And then, you know, once you're out there swimming, your characters will become who they are and the story will be what it will be. But that initial push off to use, you know, what you need to use of your own life to get you started. I don't know. Did that feel like a gift or?
Well, it opened up a door, and it also opened up a lot of difficulties to the process. What I ended up doing is I went to this instructor that I had, because I was just writing scenes, and he said, you know, you don't have a narrative arc here.
Hmm.
And I said, I really need a dilemma for Judy, my main character, who that's got the same kind of gravitas that I went through. And I can't think of what it was, and I was telling him all these specific things that I'd gone through, and he looked at me like I had two heads, and he goes, Rita, you're a writer. This is what writers do. So that allowed me not to be self-indulgent. That's what I had felt. Like, for example, I could very easily have called my main character, who they all have musical names, and I called her Judy Blue Eyes, and I could easily have called her Lovely Rita,
mm-hmm,
but I did not do that. I thought that was a little much. But then that also took me into, so that allowed me a way in. But I have to say that the most difficult process of writing the story was to let go of things that really happened and have it create its own fictional life.
Right.
There were many times where I just resisted going places and resisted workshop comments because in my head I was going, but that's not exactly what happened.
Uh-huh.
And I had to just let that go, and I did it 2 weeks into a very intense residency at the Ragdale Foundation in Chicago. Cool. And that's when I just let go, and suddenly the characters were going the way they wanted to go, and it became a fictional novel at that point.
Interesting.
It was very hard.
That's interesting. One thing you said that I'm so happy you said is that you initially were writing this as fragments or as, you know, different scenes. And
yes.
I know so many writers in writing groups I've been in that have worked that way. And it inevitably seems to be so hard for them then to piece it together, you know, because then they'll have 400 pages of fragments and scenes, which does not a novel make. And, but it is a very hard inclination to get away from doing it that way. So if you could talk just for a second, I think this would be so helpful for people to hear, how you made that transition from having a pile of fragments to having a novel.
Well, it was extremely painful. So, the first fragment I wrote was the story I referenced a few minutes ago about the vet.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to do it as a series of link stories, and I think I was just being lazy because I thought that would be easier.
Mm-hmm.
So all the linked stories were really fragments that took place at the end of the book. And then I realized that this was a novel. So I had these fragments. And I had one, you know, on lottery night. I had, like, the big fragment scenes. But I had to go all the way back and create a beginning.
Mm-hmm.
How would this story start? It wasn't just my way into it. It was like, what is the scene on page one? And for years I kept thinking, boy, if I could just put these all on an arc, you know, like a clothesline, in the order that they need to be,
mm-hmm.
and then I could sit back and edit, that would be wonderful. But it took such a long time to do it because I wrote it over a long period of time. There was legacy writing in it. I had, you know, you had to give up on things that you really loved, that people had loved in workshop, and it was really, really hard to do that. And it was like doing a synopsis backwards.
Uh-huh.
Which is what I did, and I won't ever do that again.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that what you did, was sort of, because I know somebody who literally did put a clothesline in her office and hung scenes off of it. Did you do that? What does your office look like?
No, I think that's but I had, one of my editors had a process where you'd use note cards for something like that.
Oh, yeah.
I wished that I had been that analytical. I just did this the hardest way you could possibly do it. Now, the way that I'm going to do the future ones are, I ended up having the good fortune of dealing with two remarkable editors while I did this. Because, you know, I came out of another career and I thought, I'm not going to live long enough to master how to do this without some expert help. So my last editor was Jacqueline Mitchard, who wrote The Deep End of the Ocean.
Uh-huh.
And I used her as a developmental editor. And she actually taught me that, you know, I'm going to try this on the next book, is to just really make such a detailed synopsis that you can call it a clothesline, you can call it a graph, you can call it an Excel sheet, whatever it is, but so that you know exactly what is going to happen.
Uh-huh.
And don't start writing until you've done that.
Uh-huh.
And I know that some writers are intuitive and they just write and find their stories, and others are overly plot-oriented. I started out being overly, and I backed into the rest of it. This time I just want to have some structure to it so that I get a better sense of where I'm going, knowing full well that it will change.
Right.
But I won't be, like, writing into the deep beyond.
Right.
Yeah.
Good advice, yeah. My guest this morning is Rita Dragonette. The book, The 14th of September, is out and available now. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. You also mentioned legacy writing. I haven't heard that term, but I really like that term. I'm going to steal that now. But when you write over the course of 12 years, obviously you change as person, as writer. Hopefully you get better as writer. And so you do have all of these pages, I guess, that don't match the current pages. And I was just wondering about that process of, you know, kind of what you do with 12 years of writing to keep everything kind of currently in the voice you have today.
That, again, was another thing that was so incredibly hard, because I would, over that period of time, sometimes I took a year off. You know, and then I would come back, and I would go back and forth and do these things. And I learned to write tighter. I'm a very good dialogue writer.
Yes, you are.
But what I, thank you.
Yes.
But what I end up doing is, because I am, often my dialogue scenes are too long.
Hmm.
And I can, you know, and people will tell me that, but they can't exactly tell you which ones are too long or where they're too long. And then you'd get all this feedback, but it's really, really good. And you were in the middle of this going, well, what's the part that goes, you know?
Right.
So then you had to go back, and I know that some of those were, almost all of those were legacy writing things because they were so much fun to write, and they just, like, pour out of me, and then I didn't want to give them up.
Yeah.
And as the story went on, particularly as you can tell in the novel, it gets faster and faster as it goes.
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, there's the big scenes at the end. Those don't have as much dialogue.
Uh-huh. Right.
They have hopefully the critical amount of dialogue, but they don't have long dialogue scenes, and they don't have, it just moves much faster.
Right.
And then it did in the beginning, and it was really hard to get the pace to match. And I don't think it, you know, I'm sure I'm going to read this in a, you know, 2 years and go, oh my God, I left that in there. Why didn't I take that out? But it's very hard to have perspective on your own writing, even if it's legacy writing.
Yes, right. And every writer does that. I haven't talked to a single writer who says I wouldn't go back and fiddle with it. So I think that's just built into the stock price of being a writer.
Well, and every time you read a scene, I'm going to a salon in an hour, and I'm going to read a scene, and every time I read it, I go, oh, I should have changed that.
I'll change that, right.
Yeah, I could do that tighter. I could be tighter with that.
You can do that during the reading, you know. They'll never know. Well, maybe they would know.
Well, I do have reading scripts, you know, where you take out references to other scenes in the book that are irrelevant, and it makes all the difference in the world when you're reading.
Yes, right. And another point you brought up about writing groups, I wanted to touch on, because I've been in a writing group for a really long time, and the group has been together for a long time, and we always have this debate about when to show each other work, what critiques to listen to, and sometimes I'm critiquing people's work, and I'm like, maybe I'm just saying this to say something, and I'm actually really hurting this person, or not hurting the person, but just, you know, I'm not being helpful to the work, because, you know, we're all kind of there to say something. And so I was wondering if you could just talk about your critique group, how it works, and kind of training your ear to listen to the right critiques and to deliver the right critiques.
Yeah, well, I have a lot of experience dealing with groups and workshops going way back. And actually, this very same instructor that told me to listen to myself is the one who said at some point you're going to have to go beyond workshops.
Mm-hmm.
And I did in my PR career, of course, I was an editor a lot. And when somebody gives me a piece of writing, I take it extremely seriously.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'll go anywhere from line editing all the way to, hey, it's too slow here, it's this and this and this. And I want them to do that to me as well. But you don't always get everything that you want, you know, back from somebody. Actually, it's somebody, and all they did was circle adverbs, and it's like, well, okay. but I need something a little more meaty. And, you know, and the watchwords are what I have learned, because then I went into another writer's group, and I'm actually desperate to find a new one right now as I go into this new book,
mm-hmm.
because the people that I worked with before have dispersed.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to get back into it where I really trust it. But I wrote an article about this once, and they said, when do you show work? And my personal opinion is that you show it in two times. One is when you're running into a problem. Take it as far as you can, and you just have a problem.
Mm-hmm.
I can't make this work, and I don't know what's wrong, and I don't know what to do with it, and I need other perspective. But don't make it raw copy. Take it as far as you can to that problem so that they can look at the problem and see it very clearly as this is what needs to be fixed. They may have other ideas too,
mm-hmm.
but you won't be wasting their critical time on things you already know are wrong. And then the other thing is when you really do think you've got something that's finished, you know, whether it's a chapter or a scene or a substantial part of it, if you're feeling that this is good, it's like then it's ready for other eyes too.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the I think that a lot of people get very demoralized in groups and workshops when they take in, like, really rough work, because then you get, you just having people tell you what you know yourself.
Right.
You know.
Right.
That this is too long, that this is too this, that this is too this. And that's when it's like having respect for the other people that are in the group.
Right.
You want them to bring their best work or their most critical evaluation coming in and saying, for the life of me, I cannot come up with a beginning here that's got enough zip.
Yep.
You know, right. And I need something like that, or I think this ending works, but I am not quite sure. Or is this dialogue scene too long? Or does this really, is it as magnificent as I really think it is? And it's like a ballet and I can't take one word out.
Right. Exactly.
You know, it's those kinds of things. And my quest right now is to find a group of writers that where we're all at a similar level.
Yes.
That we're not, you're not, because very often when you have a group, you know, if there are, our writers are at different levels, you spend more time with the writers that need more help.
Right.
And you don't get what you need.
Right.
So I'm actually in the process of looking for that right now, but it's incredibly important because you never really know. You know, you're at the computer and you're just going, am I a genius today or am I just bleh?
Yeah.
No.
Right. Right.
And what will I be tomorrow?
What will I be tomorrow? Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
That was Rita Dragonette sharing her debut novel, The 14th of September. Again, that interview goes on for about another 5 minutes. So if you want the full, if you're interested in that, want the full copy, that's going to be up and available on our podcast. That's all the time we have for today. This has been Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Stay tuned for Jazzy Rhythms. Coming up next, Hidden Gems with DJ Scat Cat and more great programming all day long on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great, great day.